We're joined today by Nick Matthew, who, unless Mike is hiding a secret tiddlywinks kind of expertise, is the first world number one we've ever had on the podcast. So, Nick, welcome. And can you tell us a little bit about, well, who you are and why we know you?
Oh, thanks. Mike didn't tell me that I was going to be put on the speaker.
Oh, yeah. Give us that bio. Here we go.
Yeah, I'm a three-time world squash champion. Three-time Commonwealth Games gold medalist, and best win of my career was beating a young Mike Hughes in the New Brighton under 14 squash open back in 1993.
For no points?
No, I think it was a bit closer than that, but we have known each other a long time. We have known each other a long time, haven't we? Played in the junior days, so it's good to catch up.
We have. I've taken many a beating at your hands in the junior days and at national squads and things.
I was a bit of a later developer, so I wouldn't be surprised if you beat me, to be fair, back in those days. But
I reckon I might snuck a game at most. I definitely didn't get a win. I'm such a late developer, I'm still waiting to develop now.
Still though, Mike, I mean that's tending to looking better for you than it has for Nick there, that you pushed him close.
The test is going so far, it's proving my rep, no end.
No, I think we were lucky in squash, you know, three actually, if we include your dad, Mike, who was obviously one of the preeminent, if not the preeminent, sort of godfather of the use of video analysis and stuff in sports. Stafford Murray as well.
Yeah.
Himself. People who've gone a long way in the industry who were had a pedigree in squash in the early kind of days. So I think as a sport, we've used this sort of thing a lot over the years. We've been sort of one of the first sports who've used it, really.
Yeah. Squash was always, you know, an early adopter. And again, you know, we were as lucky as the quality of the coaches and the quality of the players and the open-mindedness of those guys to take anything on board that they thought could make them better.
Probably use it more then than now, to be fair.
I think, yeah, I'm sure that's the case. You know, some of that's budgetary and, you know, things like that. Some of it might be sort of attitude towards it, I don't know. But, you know, back in the day, I'm sounding really old now, aren't we? But, you know, our generation of players and the generation just before, the Peter Nichols and Lee Beachels and those guys, used data analysis a hell of a lot, didn't they? And really took it on board, really applied it in a positive way for training and match play and opposition analysis. And as you say, a lot of the sort of the forefathers of performance analysis did the early work in squash. A, because it was it was a sport that lends itself well to analysis. Everyone's locked in a room, they're not going anywhere. But also, like I say, my old man was an enthusiastic squash coach and squash player himself.
Sounds a bit like now, doesn't it? Locked in a room, not going anywhere.
Please let me out.
So we touched on it there, Mike, but Nick, why do you think squash did suit itself to being analysed so much?
I think Mike's right. I think, you know, it's one of those sports where even if you know what you're watching, if you get two players who are quite close seemingly sort of to the naked eye, it's quite hard to work out, you know, why one, if there's a big gulf in standard, you can see it. But if there's those small differences in standard, it's sometimes quite hard to work out why one person's winning but the other. You know, it's a fast-paced game. You know, the margins are very, very fine. And I think unless you kind of analyse it and break it down, it's very hard to find those little kind of 1 or 2% that you put in. Otherwise, it can become a very reactive game and something will just happen or might just hinge on one point or one rally or one turning point. And, you know, you're just trying to break it down with a few concrete stats that you can base a game plan around or base training around or, you know, analyse opponent's strengths and weaknesses and your own strengths and weaknesses. You know, I'm talking tactically now, but there's also the other side to it that I know Mike wanted to ask me about in terms of analysing your own game and your own sort of techniques that you use to maximise those. So many ways to break it down, but I think in a nutshell, because it's such a fast-moving sport, that can be great, but it can mean that things can happen too quickly without breaking it down into kind of more slow detail.
And how would you, from a tactical perspective, just to start with, how would you sort of break down your time in terms of looking at opposition versus looking at your own game? would you go into every match knowing, you know, various strengths and weaknesses of the opponent and the data to back that up?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is that, you know, I think when I used those sort of tactical analysis as the most was when you'd got yourself to a point where you, ideally you know your own game or you know your own strengths to a point. And of course, you're always trying to improve those, but you kind of know what you're trying to do. So it might be that you're just trying to gain an edge on analysing your opponents, whether that's the last time you played them or whether it's that opponent's last couple of matches from the day before or what they're doing now under certain conditions, and just getting a little bit of some concrete evidence into the what a game plan might be based around. And I think, you know, you'll know this from every sport, but the big danger with stats and that analysis is over analysis, isn't it? You know, and the paralysis that can then lead to. And I think squash, again, is, I mentioned it's so fast paced. If you get too analytical, you can kind of lose that reactiveness. You have to be able to react and think on the spot as well. And for me, it was just trying to spend maybe 20 minutes, half an hour on a morning of a match. And that was it. Come out with maybe one or two things max. Perhaps a backup plan, a plan B, in case the plan A doesn't work. But each of them is trying to keep it as simple as possible. Otherwise,
yeah,
you know, I think we've all been guilty at times of overusing the stats, and then it can kind of be too much.
Yeah, your head gets melted a bit. Which, just out of interest, which player did you find hardest to prepare playing against data-wise?
For me, 100% was a guy called Rami Ashour, who was, we probably had 3 or so years around 2010, 2011, 2012, where we were 1 and 2 in the world together. And there was absolutely zero patterns to his play. You could perhaps hit a real unique style, you know, no backswing, very badminton-esque a little bit in some of his swings. And we knew in the middle, on the backhand, he went for a cross-court nick and invariably got it. But it was very difficult, the stats. You know, he was known as a shot player, so you'd think, well, let's have a look at if extending the rallies creates more errors, but then he would win the larger percentage of the long rallies. So then you just get really confused. He'd hit most of his winners on the backhand, so then you think, well, maybe let's play a bit more on the forehand side, but he didn't make many errors on that side. So then you just felt like you were second guessing yourself all the time.
Right, with him. Circles a bit.
Yeah, a little bit. A lot of the other players, you know, obviously I think the better you go in any sport, those stats, you know, needle in a haystack springs to mind. You know, you find maybe just trying to find one little nugget. I remember Mohamed El Shabagi, who I was maybe getting to past my peak when I was playing him. So trying to find a nugget was harder than it was when I was at the peak of my own game. I felt like I was maybe trying to limit him rather than imposing my own game by...
Or maximising your strengths.
Yeah, and... One thing that came out, it took so long to find something, and that was that at the start of each game, he really tried to shorten the rallies and get some quick winners and get a bit of a lead. He was a front runner. He liked a fast pace, get a bit of a lead, and then he could almost take a bit of a break before going again. And we just kind of put a big little, I think a couple of times I beat him towards the end, didn't get many towards the end, but managed to kind of hold him at the start of each game and just made him think twice by kind of pushing up higher on the tee with a dead ball at the start of each game, and that kind of made a little difference. So Sometimes with the higher players, you're having to really think outside the box to find anything. You know, with a lower ranked player, 10 things might pop up.
And like you say, there'll be a bit of a bigger gap there where, like you say, you're probably focusing more on your own game and imposing what you're good at and your strengths rather than worrying too much about them.
Someone like a Gregory Gaultier was an amazing example of it. You know, James Willstrop was a player I played the most in my career. I think we played 80-odd times, but we actually didn't do too much stats on each other, remarkably, because we were both as part of the same English program. So They obviously didn't team up and you know, pair us off against each other. That was a bit like, lads, you're on your own, get on with it. Gregory Gaultier is probably the second person I played the most, and he had French flair, Greg, but he was very sort of robotic in that he liked to do things, and it came out that on the backhand he basically played straight 90% of the time, and on the forehand he played cross court sort of 90% of the time. So, you know, just these little patterns that would play where he'd just occasionally go into robotic mode and you could maybe just pick up one or two things. But again, when you get to the top players, that the only way you can find something, I think, is the stats, because with the naked eye, you just wouldn't see it.
No. So on that, Nick, obviously in boxing, for example, which I know is very different because you're facing one opponent and you're building up to that one opponent for a long time. You know, if you're facing a tall left-handed boxer, you might spar against a tall left-handed boxer. Did you ever try and find training partners who played in a certain way in terms of people that you thought you were going to be facing?
I think the biggest example I can think of that is a guy called Jonathan Kemp, who was an English player. You know, the Egyptians are known for being sort of very wristy shot makers, looking for shorter rallies. The English players, you know, I'm generalising here, but the English players were known for a lot more structure, trying to build rallies, longer rallies, play the backcourt first. And I used to hate playing Jonathan Kemp in training because I used to feel there's no rhythm. The rallies were short. I couldn't get into my stride. I couldn't play to my strengths. I used to avoid him. He'd ring me up for a game. I'd say, oh, even if he was ranked below me, I'd be like, no, Kempy, I'm busy this week. I realised the more and more Egyptians that came to the top, and the way that I needed to adapt to that style of game. So I would search out a Jonathan, because playing this sort of traditional English style player wasn't preparing me to play a Rami or Shaw. So I'd search out a Jonathan, and I'd found that as long as I approached it with the right mindset, that it benefited me and it got my feet moving, it sharpened me up for that. So there's definitely an element to that. But as you say, you're not preparing for one opponent for kind of a year in advance. You know, you get past one and the next day you've got somebody else, so it's hard to I think Rami was perhaps the only person I ever analyzed until I was sort of blue in the face, because it was just trying to figure out what's going on, because it was so different, and almost focused on him to a little bit in the neglect of myself at one point in my career. But everyone else, it was pretty much focus on yourself and just take one or two things that you can add.
We've talked obviously about, I guess, quite far into your career. Do you remember what the first bit of analysis, or kind of the first general ideas you were getting in terms of analysis?
Yeah, actually, the first bit of analysis I saw was, the first time I saw it was probably something by Mike's dad, and it was about sort of scoring systems and trying to create more pressure points in squash and the stats behind that. So it was less about how it would benefit your own game. But I just was definitely fascinated by that analysis side of it. So I remember, because I'd read about that, I remember when it came to be involved in our sort of England squads, that I was a lot more receptive towards it because I was really fascinated by it. And I know we've spoken a lot there about the tactics behind stats and how you can apply game plans, but the biggest use of it I found in my early career was actually dissecting technique. And for me, particularly like a technical fault that I couldn't figure out just with feel or with the naked eye. It took a lot of video analysis to sort of put that right, particularly on my backhand side.
Mm. And you went through quite a big period of evolution in your backhand early on in your career, didn't you? Which was a huge amount of work between yourself, your coach and analyst at the time. Do you just want to talk us through how that sort of happened and why that happened and how you worked together so closely as a team?
Yeah, I reckon things like having kids and lockdown and things like that put it into perspective. But sort of at the time, it felt like, you know, as a 19-year-old, it felt like probably the hardest thing I'd ever have to do, which was basically I'd been we touched upon it at the start, I'd been a decent junior, I'd been sort of got to the national team and world championships and things like that. But actually trying to, first of all, psychologically trying to make the change, say, look, you're doing all right, you're improving, but you've got to basically learn how to hold the racket completely from scratch, because at some point you're going to hit a brick wall in the future. And, you know,
so what were you ranked at the time?
I was probably like top 200, top 150. I was 19, on an upward trajectory. I think I probably, you know, would have carried on that trajectory, because, you know, you're coming out the juniors and you're firing and your ranking starts off at 500, 600, whatever it is. So, you know, there's only one way to go, certainly to start with. So it's quite hard when you're on the up and up to say, well, to understand at some point I'm going to struggle here. And you know, the coaches were perhaps telling me, David Pearson was my coach, very technical coach, as you know, didn't have a clue about fitness, how to train, like S&C or anything like that, but amazing on the technique.
Best technical coach I've ever seen.
Best technical coach, you know, and it shows about focusing on your strengths. He knew that was what he was good at, and on the other areas. He said, look, go see someone else if you want to get fit, but I'll teach you how to hit the ball and move. And yeah, he just sort of said to me, and what I liked about his mindset, he didn't force it upon me. He kind of drip fed it in, said, I think you need to do it, but it has to come from you. And it was maybe 6 months down the line where I went to him. I said, I think I see what you mean. I think I need to do it. And he went, right, we're ready now. And then everything hit the fan. You know, it was every week. It was, you know, days before wireless and stuff. We're on there with the big or laptops. There was a big screen, you know, wires everywhere, like trying to dodge them. You know, Stafford was on the court with us in his little wheelie chair. You know, we'd hit 20 shots. We'd come, we'd dissect it in a million different angles. It was ahead of its time, I think, really.
Yeah, massively.
And I think without it, I mean, to DP always said, you never get 100% with technique. You're only ever dealing with sort of 85, 90%, and you try and keep it there. It's never going to be perfect. But I reckon to get to that sort of 85, 90%, well, it took about 3 years. And I reckon without that, it would have taken about 10, if ever. It was truly, truly unreal just to see it breaking down and things that you think are happening. You look at it on the screen and it couldn't be any different than what you think. You think something's happening, you see it back and you go, oh, wow,
fly. Yeah, I did not realise.
I did not realise I'd do that silly thing. Like my racket that I was trying to hit the ball with was facing the kind of back of the court on my backhand. I had, you know, how is that going to be consistent? And I had no clue that was happening. Things like that. And it, learning how to hit the ball again, basically, was a bit of a challenge when you kind of got the ego to play with of a young athlete and you're on the up and up and you go back to basically shanking it into the roof. You know,
this is embarrassing. But without blowing too much smoke up Dave Pearson's behind, his feel for what a racket and the grip and the hand and the racket base should be doing through a swing to impact and follow through, like you say, it was so far ahead of his time. And he was coaching things that people didn't necessarily agree with until we could demonstrate it on high-speed footage. Do you remember the high-speed camera? And it showed, you know, the racket face coming through and then being flat to impact, and everybody was coaching open racket face. And he's like, no, it's flat at impact. And then you break and follow through. And he was the only person coaching that way at the time, because that's what he felt and the sensations, and he understood it. And, you know, however he came to that, he got to that point, didn't he, through his experiences and years of watching the sport. And it was only once we could go to 500 frames a second video footage, we could actually show that. And like you say, you're seeing all sorts of stuff going on, going, oh my God, I did not realise, you know, that was happening.
Yeah. No wonder I'm crap, sort of thing.
I look terrible. What do you think was the thing that made you go, like you said, he was sort of nudging you a little bit. I think you should maybe look at your grip and your swing. What was the thing that sort of tipped you over the edge to go, right, I'm ready to take this on, this, you know, 2-3 year challenge that's going to make sure I've got no walls in front of me that I hit?
Yeah, simply, I mean, I was always, fitness was always a big thing for me. And I was just playing against, when I played against a better player, it just felt like it didn't matter how fit I was. I was just getting tired, simply as that. You know, they're just putting me under too much pressure with the ball. The ball was doing so much work. I was doing so much work and they were just cruising around the court simply. And I was like, well, I know I can get stronger, but at the end of the day, like, you know, I'm never going to be as fast as the ball. I'm never going to be as fit as the ball. You've got to make that thing, you've got to be in control of that more. And just very clever, you know, really clever the way of learning it rather than enforcing his views on you. He just drip fed it in and just made it my idea, which is, you know, it's parenting 101, that, isn't it?
Yeah, dealing with teenagers. Yeah.
Basically dealing with teenagers, making someone feel like your idea is actually theirs and then they want to embrace it. You know, it was good psychology, good coaching. And also, I think, you know, I knew that he'd had a track record as well. I think that was the other thing.
Yeah, there was a lot of trust.
Peter Nicol, who'd come especially from Scotland, you know, it's big front page newspaper news that when he moved from Scotland to England, it was very controversial. And, you know, a lot of that was to get that sort of expertise and the support on the you know, that he was playing Jonathan Powers and people like that. And he wanted to be number one in the world. And he felt like Scotland were providing that, but England were. And that support team of physios video analysis and everything like that that he was getting. So the track record was there. You know, so you're foolish not to. It's not like you were a trailblazer for it. It had been done before with other players. And DP had done it before with other players. So it was sort of, you know, I trusted that if it was good enough for them.
Do you speak to Peter Nicol about it and get maybe his advice as a peer?
No, I don't think I needed to. You sort of witnessed it. You know, they were quite good at that sort of, you know, fast tracking myself and Adrian Grant. So we were 18 and they brought us into the national squads and you sort of saw what happened. And, you know, you didn't have to be too intelligent to realise it was a good environment going on in terms of what was happening on the court. And there was also a slightly older generation of players that were all sort of coming to the end at the same time. So they needed some fresh blood and they were willing to, if you were willing to show the work ethic and the commitment, they were willing to back you. You know, it was great days of the lottery funding had just first come out. We had all the support we wanted. It was up to us to make the most of that, really.
You touched on psychology there, which I think is crucial because obviously these podcasts are geared more towards the analysis side of things, but as we know, the psychological element is crucial. What you described there in terms of changing your backhand will probably be quite familiar to perhaps golfers who reach a 20 handicap and then can't get any further and then go to a coach who tells them, oh, yeah, this is as high as you'll go with this swing, and you know, if you want to, you're going to have to completely go back to the start. How hard was it psychologically, knowing that, as you say, you were hitting the roof with some of those shots that previously got you into the top 200, how difficult was that to kind of make sure that you wanted to keep pushing on?
Yeah, that was the biggest thing, really. You know, you hear the saying of going back a step to go forward two, but it felt like going back five, you know, at certain stages. And, you know, I actually I had a coach called Mark Hornby who was with me until I was 18 in Sheffield, and he was brilliant on the other areas, like the tactics, the physical side, the mental, but perhaps wasn't much of a technical coach. So it was an area I'd neglected. I'd made that move to DP, to David Pearson, to work specifically on the technique. And there was perhaps times then as a result, you neglected some of those other areas that had previously gone well. So your performance has definitely suffered for a while. And it required a lot of faith, you know, even your parents to question, have you made the right thing? I remember putting on a couple of kgs over that period as well, where maybe I was, like I said, focusing too much on the technique, wasn't simply training as hard. So other areas of game. So it definitely required a leap of faith. And talking about it, I'm not quite sure how I did that at that age, to be honest. But I think, as I said, like just DP's the way he taught it, he made it enjoyable. And something like that can be probably the hardest thing. You know, it's easy to go out in a way and do a hard fitness session. As hard as it is physically, you don't have to think too hard. You can just put your head down and afterwards you feel $1 million because you've burned 1,000 calories and so on, so forth. It's sort of easy to work hard in a way. But this was something else. It was just like I'd come home at the end of a day having spent 4 hours just watching my backhand on the video, and I'd just fall asleep on the settee at like 5 o'clock. And I never did that when I'd worked hard physically. It was just a different sort of investment and
huge mental engagement.
Huge mental engagement, but DP managed to always find a way to make it fun. And I just remember enjoying the process, even though it was hard. He found a way to make it enjoyable for me. So even though I wasn't necessarily improving straight away, I was enjoying my squash more than ever. So I think that was crucial.
And you're probably excited as well about the possibilities on the back of it, I guess, as well. And
yeah, I've done similar things. You know, I've had occasional golf lessons that, especially in the past year, I'm about at that point that you said, I'm about the 18 handicap who's hit a bit of a brick wall. And I've, you know, you're not going to change it overnight, but you might hit, let's say you have a lesson on the golf range and you hit 100 shots, you might hit five out of those 100 where you go, wow, that was it. You can't do it again for another 20 shots, but you're at least hitting one or two that you go, okay, I see what I'm striving for here. And that was very much as it was with the technique. You know, you'd have enough encouragement within the garbage to stick at it, really.
Do you know how much of that type of analysis sort of goes on these days with the current generation of players? Is it something that's continued? I know we touched on it perhaps doesn't happen as much in England anymore because of resources and things like that. Is it going on elsewhere in the game?
I know the tactical side, the game plans side, you know, obviously, you know, you could simply do that, can't you? Even without the budget, you can do that on a kind of pen and paper if you want, like a little bit of
a hand notation.
Yeah, a bit of a simple, isn't it? But you can still do some of that without the budget. But I know that is happening on various levels of research from the national squad down. I think it's the technical side that's not happening as much. And I think how time consuming it is. People just, I don't know whether the modern player has that mental, it's a different era. You know, they don't quite have the same mental concentration span. You know, we're on the eras of social media and gadgets and technology. People want instant fix. They're not willing to spend 18 months working on something. They want an instant gratification, instant improvement. They want to work hard. They want to train hard. It's about how many calories have you burned? What was your max heart rate? And it's in, you know, stats are coming in more and more on the physical side, aren't they? Like, yeah, you know, what your heart rate was in that rally and how long you spent in the red zone and so on. So actually it's something I've brought back in myself a lot lately. Just simply, you've not got the, you know, it's time consuming to do what you did before with a big TV screen and budgetary, as you said, but just simple videos on the phone, just put them in an app, just slow them down, just look back on it. Maybe at the end of a session, send a little 2.5 minute video summarizing the before and after, a little split screen, and that's it. Keep it simple. But I'm definitely already, that's sort of one of my coaching goals for 2021, is to bring a simpler form of that back, because I think it's an art that's been forgotten.
Is that something you want to deliver throughout your academy that you've set up, Nick?
100%. Yeah, I think, as you say, like when you've got one person after the other and it's busy and you kind of can think, well, you know, doing that technique, you can come off and your heart rate's never been above like 110 and you've not even got sweat on, and you sometimes always guilty maybe of thinking, I want to give the player a good session and let them feel good. And sometimes you've just got to pick the moments to take a step back and actually look at hard improvements.
And what are the ages that you're working with in your academy, Nick?
So mainly, so we do have a junior arm and an arm where we go into schools. You know, that's led by some of the other members of sort of our team. Myself personally, I work with players who are either looking to turn professional or already young professionals and up. So the youngest player I work with has just turned 16. And the oldest is 32. She won't thank me for saying that, but so it's anything sort of from that bracket. But probably the biggest bracket is probably between sort of 19 and 22, where they're sort of those young, hungry players looking at trying to get out there in the big wide world and see how they can do.
And do you see many people in that age bracket who were similar to you, who have a you know, technical flaw that not only needs to be tweaked, but perhaps needs to be completely rebuilt?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in different levels, you know, everyone has got errors and, you know, just trying to find the ways to, you know, not everyone's got the same personality type as well, right? So I think half of it is understanding how their personalities kind of tick so that you know the best ways to bring things in. As I mentioned before, you know, it's only one of several areas as well. You might have players who, technically they're quite good, but they other areas they might need to focus on first or vice versa. So I think just understanding the makeup of a player, what makes them tick and where their strengths lie, then you can sort of, I think, you know, come at it from an area, right, where are they weak, where they need to improve, and also remembering, not forgetting to say, look, just because a player's strong technically, that you can just neglect it, you still have to work on the strengths as well. Basically, you run out of time to do everything, but you try your best.
And I guess before we go on to the final three questions, squash, like tennis and also like golf that we've mentioned, suits itself to, I guess, quite a lot of self-analysis. You know, you can just stick your iPhone on a stand and hit some serves and, you know, and see how you're doing. Is that something that you're seeing people do, perhaps not at the professional level or turning professional, but just, you know, amateurs who are looking to improve their game?
I think so, yeah. There's, you know, there's a lot more gadgets out there for people to sort of have a go at themselves at home. And I think that can only be good for the game, to be honest. As I said, it's something that I saw a lot years gone by, and then it's sort of gone out of the game a little bit. And I think we've seen signs in the last couple of years that in different forms, you know, it's coming back in, which is good.
We always ask three questions of our guests, so the usual suspects questions. So the first one, Nick, is what, if anything, Mike's including commas, if anything, got you excited about using data and analysis?
Well, I think...
or got the blood pumping, data-wise.
Got the blood pumping. I think just seeing the benefit that the people who came before me had got from it, and just wanting to, you know, fear of missing out, really, bit of FOMO, and, you know, wanting to be part of that, especially when I saw, you know, deficiencies in my own game that the naked eye perhaps didn't ping up.
And what data did you, and I guess do you use most regularly?
It was two phases. Start of my career most regularly was the sort of technical breakdown, and then back end of my career most regularly was the sort of match analysis. So it was almost like a two-part, really, two parts to my career.
Was there any where would you start in terms of your match analysis, in terms of like your sort of process to go through it? Which bit would you start with? Would you look at sort of winner and error distributions to start with, or?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the order. I think winner error distribution of your opponent. If you're just looking at an opponent, you know, winner error to start with, you know, is there a red flag there, an area to kind of watch out for? Is an area where they seem to make a lot of errors? Is it a one-off match, or is that a pattern over a few matches? Because obviously you do get odd matches where certain things fire more than others, but, you know, looking for any patterns, I guess. Then would move on perhaps to rally length was a good one. And the other one that came in later on was sort of momentum as well, which to mention sort of Mohamed El-Shabagi was a big one for the momentum.
Was he?
Yeah, just the start of each game, you know, just trying to arrest that momentum sort of straight away, really. I guess, you know, on top of that, the simple ones, we mentioned the ability to sort of do it on your own, just sometimes simply, how many winners, how many errors did you hit in that game? I remember recently talking to a player, Declan James, that I work with currently, and he lost the first game of a match 13-11. And watching it, I thought he played fantastic in that game. He had 2-3 game balls, lost it, came off and changed his complete game plan in the second game and looked a bit sort of all at sea and didn't quite play as well and ended up losing the match. And I said to him, thought he played really well in the first game. I thought you were doing everything right. It was more a case of coming back on in the second game and saying, look, I did everything well, same again. And I think sometimes you're so swayed by the winning and the losing that you don't and stats sometimes give you that reassurance. All right, the execution might not have been 100%, but the plan was right. And that's, you know, it's almost like the stats give you that knowledge. And when Declan, he went, nah, I felt awful in the first. But then when he watched it back, he said he made 10 errors. Sorry, not 10, that would have been bad. 10 winners, 10 winners and one error in the first game. And he lost it 13-11. And he went, oh, I didn't realise that. Yeah, I played great. I should have just carried on. And, you know, it was maybe more a case of that game ball up. He just got a little bit tight on game ball or whatever. But everything was good. And I think stats, you know, it was only through looking at the stats that he realised, he learned a valuable lesson, which was, you know, sometimes just stick at it. You know, sometimes if you win a game and play badly, it's like players think, go carry on. But lose a game and play well, they'll go, oh, I've got to change something. And the winning and losing can distort the stats, really.
Yeah, don't let the outcome affect your perception of the process. And like you said, he's got a 10-1 winner error ratio. He's going to win that game 19 times out of 20.
100%, yeah.
But you can't control the outcome, you're right.
That happens all the time in lower level rugby, where someone scores a try and you all stand under the post accusing each other of everything's going wrong. And you think, you know, people score tries in rugby, don't they? Yeah. You're not going to keep a clean sheet the whole time.
Yeah.
So, last one, what does data do, what doesn't data do, or the analysis do, that you would like it to do?
Oh, tough question. I guess following up on what we just said, it doesn't, you know, unfortunately, and I don't know if it ever will, it doesn't give you all the answers, does it? You know, it gives you, as we said, it gives you that picture. You can't look for the whole answers, the whole thing inside it. You know, for me, it's picking out those one or two little nuggets. And it would be fantastic if those one or two little nuggets would be you know, highlighted or stand out more, quite often they can be hidden in the stats, and it might only be your mindset or thought process or past experience from the same opponent or something like that that highlights them, or a coach, you know, framing it a different way. So they're not always obvious, the things that you're looking for in stats. They can be very well hidden. But, you know, so I think short of them being more obvious, which I don't know is possible, it's up to you guys to maybe find ways to do that. But they don't always provide the answers. They only provide a small piece of the puzzle, don't they? Very important piece, don't get me wrong. But, you know, I think people can put too much, very important piece, but people can put, you still got to go out there and execute. You know, you can have all the information in the world. You still got to go out there and perform, haven't you? It doesn't, they don't perform for you.
Oh, and you know, I was going to just sort of wrap up at the end with you've been sort of very modest in terms of talking about that development that you made technically and tactically over a period of time, and you made it sound like data and analysis had a huge part in that. But like you say, actually, it was just a small part. It was your incredible work ethic and application over years and years and years that made that happen. It wasn't the data or the analysis that highlighted things, but you've got to have the coach and the athlete and the energy levels and the dedication and the commitment and the open-mindedness to make it happen. It's not the data that makes it happen. It's the athlete and the coach.
Yeah, energy levels is a good one.
They're low at the moment. I know mine are.
No, you get into your fifth decade and you fight those energy, that two kids, those energy levels, perhaps not what they were, but we're trying hard. You know, I think it's... you know, it's important, I think, to lead from the front, especially what I'm doing now. You know, you come in each day, and even if you're having a garbage day, you're trying to put a positive energy on things and positive scent on things. And that's when I hope that you get people to buy into your ideas, right?